Thank you, Your Honor. May it please Court, Counsel. Mrs. Bryson, who also was known as Mrs. Barnes primarily during the trial in this case, and that's how we've referred to her in our briefs, and the government have a drastically different view about the nature and the impact of the evidence that was presented over defense objection and over denial of defense pretrial motion in limine pertaining to her home shopping habits in this case. Over a period from October of 2000 until February of 2001, evidence at trial showed that Ms. Barnes' involvement in this conspiracy primarily occurred during that period of time. The government, during the course of the trial, then also during that period of time, and these are temporally related to the charges, spent sums that were debited from her checking account for items that she purchased on two home shopping television networks in the same time period. The totals of those were summarized in Government Exhibit 501. They were also itemized, so the number of purchases per month, which were a number of purchases, they were all primarily small, between $25 and $50, was also put before the jury. The government's position is that that evidence is not inadmissible under Rule 403 and Rule 404 because of what the government's purpose of the offer was, or the spin on the evidence, which I think counsel mentioned about three or four times in her brief in this case. What spin did the government put on the evidence? The government contends that they had a right to show where the money went that she allegedly obtained by commission of mortgage fraud in this case. And I think arguably they did have that right to do that, you know, but they didn't do it in an appropriate way.
Well, did you offer to stipulate that your client had expenditures exceeding her lawful income?
No, because we did not believe that that was the case. And we believe that the evidence that...
If you're not willing to stipulate, then it seems to me you have to allow the prosecutor to put on proof.
Well, as long as that proof comports with Rule 403 and Rule 404B. It's clear that a home shopping habit is the type of evidence that is covered.
You know, we've rejected essentially identical arguments by defendants who said, well, government shouldn't be allowed to show that my client spent the money gambling, or the government shouldn't be allowed to show that my client spent the money on fur coats because jurors don't like people who are ostentatiously spending, or people don't like gamblers. We rejected those arguments. Spending the money on the home shopping on TV seems about the most innocuous of any of these we've ever heard. If we reject the gambling on the fur coat argument, how could we accept the home shopping network argument?
Good question. I believe that if you would have asked me that question 2 years ago, Judge, I would have agreed with you. In May of 2001, at its annual meeting, the American Psychiatric Association found that compulsive shopping is a disorder, a type of obsessive compulsive disorder.
It's
therefore
not an order. It's not a disorder that we found is appropriate for a departure under the guidelines.
I think the question is different whether it could be used for a departure where those types of departures are presumed.
I'm sure the American Psychiatric Association has said that compulsive gambling is a disorder.
They have.
So how does this distinguish your case from the person who says they shouldn't show that my client spent the money gambling?
I think it's because the uncharged misconduct needs to be looked at on a case-by-case basis.
You'll have to excuse me, but I don't think buying things on the home shopping network is misconduct. Well, or is gambling. It's perfectly lawful.
That depends on who's buying it.
Right.
Well, I think, and what we've tried to point out in our brief, that
if you buy more than 5,000 Jinsu knives off of TV, that's misconduct. But short of that, it's probably not.
Well, I think the operative question is, how did the jury take it? How did the jury take this? Is this the type of conduct that could be so prejudicial that it would be unfairly prejudicial under Rule 404? It's our contention that it is, that there be, if the American Psychiatric Association has found this to be a recognized DSM-4.
You're not answering my question how this distinguishes it from gambling, which is compulsive gambling is a disorder.
The answer, my answer to your question is this. In reported decisions, things like drug use and gambling and so forth have not been found to require reversal under Rule 404. There are other cases where trial judges have found that that type of conduct does require that the evidence be excluded. It depends on the case. It depends on all the other evidence.
Well, as soon as you say that, you lose. Because if it depends on the case, then it's a discretionary call for the district court to make.
That's the standard of review which we concede. We believe in this particular case the discretion was abused, in particular because the evidence in that exhibit...
You realize what a laughingstock we would be if we would say it's okay to show the defendant spent the money gambling, but to show she spent it buying items advertised on TV, that would go too far.
I think it would not... the court would not be a laughingstock if Your Honor's statement was concluded by saying, but in this case, it went too far. I need to defer to counsel. Thank you.
Yes, sir. All right.
May it please the court. Your Honor, my name is Tom Brodnick, and I am here today for the appellant Melvin Girton. Your Honor, there are three issues that I don't think are in dispute with regard to this case. One is that an indigent defendant like Mr. Girton has a constitutional and a statutory right to expert assistance in a proper case. Number two is that the district court determined that in this case we do have such a proper case when it awarded fees for Mr. Girton to hire an expert. The third thing that I don't think is in dispute is that the expert that Mr. Girton eventually was able to hire was ill-prepared to counter the testimony of the government expert because of a lack of time, a lack of preparation time. He was unable to review Mr. Girton's appraisals, he was unable to review the appraisals performed by the government expert, and he was unable to issue any opinions one way or the other as to whether the government expert's opinions were accurate or inaccurate. The question then becomes, whose fault is that? And the way I look at it, Your Honors, there are only two possibilities. One is the defense's fault, and with all due respect, the other is the district court's fault. The government concedes in its brief that the defense acted expeditiously in requesting fees for an expert. And indeed, we agree with that position. We requested fees, additional fees, 3 months prior to the trial in sufficient time for our expert to do what needed to be done. Indeed, we would note that the government's expert began his work preparing his expert report at the same time as we requested those additional fees. There was only about a 2-week difference. So we certainly agree that the defense in this case acted expeditiously. With regard to the case law that revolves around the grant or the denial of a continuance, it's clear that we need that there is an abuse of discretion standard, which the court has already indicated is a high standard. We submit to that. However, it is the standard, and we have to measure that against the constitutional dictates of Ake versus Oklahoma, which indicates that an indigent defendant is entitled to a fair playing field, a level playing field, and is able to have access to those experts. The cases that uphold the denials of continuance, we would submit, fall into three broad categories. One are cases such as Maybrook in this court, where the district court determined and the court of appeals determined no expert was necessary. The other is cases where, the second are cases where the court determined there actually was adequate preparation time. And the third type of case is where the defendant created the problem himself. Such as the Agwaji case, which the government cited. In this case, the district court determined we did need an expert, so those cases don't apply. With regard to adequate preparation time, the uncontroverted evidence is that the experts which we submitted affidavits for indicated they needed 60 to 75 days to prepare to get ready for trial. So the evidence is uncontradicted that we needed that amount of time in order to prepare for trial, and this is not a case where the defendant caused any problems with the possible delay in the trial. We acted expeditiously. We asked for that request for an expert 3 months prior to trial, and there is simply nothing we could have done with our expert withdrawing. As the court is aware, our expert withdrew when we were requested by the district court to obtain a flat fee for that expert, and that was what prompted the withdrawal, and that is what prompted our request for a continuance. Thank you, Your Honor. I see my time is expired.
All right, counsel. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, James Hanlon on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, I'm going to be addressing the argument presented this morning by Mr. Brodnick, which relate to the defendant Melvin Girton in this case, and then my co-counsel, Ms. Idy, will be addressing the arguments raised by Mr. McShane relating to Deb Barnes. The first issue that was raised by Mr. Girton in this appeal has to do with the district court's denial of the motion to continue. On this issue, the government submits that this should be reviewed under the traditional standard for a motion to continue, which is an abuse of discretion, and that the court should focus on two factors. That is, whether the court's decision here was arbitrary, and secondly, whether Mr. Girton can show that he suffered actual prejudice as a result of the court's decision to not continue the trial in this case. The government can submit that the district court's decision not to continue the trial was not arbitrary. This was a complex, week-long case that the court had to clear out an entire week on its docket for. There were multiple defendants involved in this case, and the district court had already granted Mr. Girton's previous request to continue the trial. Mr. Girton had 8 full months to prepare his defense in this case. As far as the showing of actual prejudice is concerned, the government submits that that has not been shown here. Mr. Girton had one expert retained very early on in the case when the district court immediately granted his request for appointment of an expert in funds. That expert subsequently withdrew. That is true. However, the court later granted Mr. Girton's second request for additional funds for yet another expert, and that expert was Mr. Girton notified the court that he had retained that expert, I believe, on January 7th of 2003, and the funds were then allocated, $13,500 in additional funds for this expert, on January 13th, which was a full month before the trial in this case. And I think what the issue boils down to as to whether or not Mr. Girton can show prejudice here is the fact he cannot. He had an expert. The expert had plenty of time to prepare. The court will note in the record that the government's expert testified that he took approximately 3 to 4 hours to prepare each one of his comprehensive appraisal reports, and that he worked a grand total of approximately 40 to 60 hours on this case. Mr. Girton's expert had at least a month to prepare for this case and was on notice, Mr. Girton was, that is, for at least 8 months about what the properties were that were charged in this case. Based on all these factors, Mr. Girton cannot show that he suffered any actual prejudice by the court's actions, nor can he show that the court's decision to deny the motion to continue was arbitrary. As far as the other issues that have been raised by Mr. Girton in this case are concerned, two of the issues have to do with the introduction of evidence at trial. The court admitted evidence under Rule 404B, and the other issue dealing with an evidentiary ruling was the district court's decision denying Mr. Girton's attempt to introduce evidence of an appraisal report that he had done well after he had been indicted. As the court is aware, both of those decisions are reviewed under the highly deferential abuse of discretion standard.
Was the court figuring properly on the amount lost?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Was the court's accounting of the amount lost accurate?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it was. What I understand the challenge in that issue to be, what Mr. Girton alleges there, is that the court had to have expert testimony as a prerequisite in order to find that each one of the
there is no such law.
Appraisal, yes. Yes, Your Honor. Okay. That is the government's position on that point, is that the district court was not required to have expert testimony on that point, and that the court properly drew inferences, and that the court properly calculated the amount of loss of applicable in this case, attributable to Mr. Girton. If the court has no further questions at this time, I will rest on the rest of our arguments that have been incorporated in our brief and submit the remainder of my time to Ms. Eide. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. Donna Eide for the United States. I'll address any issues the court may have with regard to the issues raised by Ms. Barnes. There were three of them. Two are reviewed by, of course, the highly deferential abuse of discretion standard. I believe the issue she raised with regard to the district court's decision not to depart is not reviewable at all.
Do you have any questions, Frank? Do you have any, Terry? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
No questions. Give me time. Thank you, gentlemen. Court will proceed to case number